The next case on our calendar is 07615, Dusty Rhodes, Auditor of Hamilton County versus M.A. Richter Villa Limited. Mr. Ray.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I am Nicholas Ray of the law firm Siegel, Siegel, Johnson & Jennings, and we represent the property owners in this case. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Your time there in the clock.
Thank you. Your Honors, this case turns on the question of whether the real property taxation of a build-to-suit property can vary based upon the business success of the tenant of that property. Ohio taxpayers already pay considerable taxes based upon the business success of their enterprise. Real estate taxes are not supposed to be one of them. This case is on appeal from the Ohio Board of Tax Appeal. The property in question is a Walgreens drugstore. The evidence shows was built to suit to meet the unique requirements of Walgreens. Improvements, which the expert testimony shows, are not similarly valued by the market. They are value and use to Walgreens. The resulting lease for 60 years reflects an amortization of the construction cost. The lease was not the result of an open market transaction. The property was never available on the open market. In this regard, the transaction is more akin to a sale leaseback transaction. The lease reflects its value and use. This concept of value and use has been recognized by this court. It was recognized by the BTA on a substantially similar property, a decision the BTA released just before this court's Berea decision. It's discussed in detail in Mr. Lorm's appraisal report, and it's discussed in the appraisal of real estate. We are before this court today because the Ohio Board of Tax Appeals has interpreted this court's Berea decision as requiring a blind acceptance of an arm's length sale price as the property's true value. That position is inconsistent with the recent decisions of this court and even with this court's decision in Berea. The property in question was originally valued by the Hamilton County Auditor based upon the transfer price. The property owners filed a complaint, contested that value. Both Mr. Lorms, the appraiser for the property owners, and Ms. Ebert, the county's appraiser, testified before the County Board of Revision. That County Board of Revision found that the sale did not reflect the true value of the property, and found that the opinion of value expressed by Mr. Lorms reflected the value of the real property. After that decision, the county auditor appealed to the Board of Tax Appeals. The BTA never evaluated the evidence that was before the county, and that the county had found justified the lower value.
Counsel, sorting these cases out is a little bit tricky. Clearly, someone thought that this property was worth, or this property enhanced by a lease to Walgreens was worth that number when the transaction occurred. Would it be fair to say that this wouldn't be a lot different from purchasing an annuity, that the value of the property is probably going to decline over time because of its special use, and I assume there are provisions for upgrading the property over time and who bears the cost on that, which would come into play as well. But it's really a stream of income over a, 60-year period of time?
60-year lease, Your Honor. And Your Honor makes exactly the correct distinction. The buyers in this case are looking at the income stream from the property. It's effectively what's known as a bondable lease. The lease in this case is secured by a high credit tenant. That tenant in this case has agreed to make payments for 60 years. We're not saying the property has no value. In fact, it has considerable value of almost $2 million. But what is being bought in this case is that income stream, like an annuity, like a bond transaction. It's a financing transaction for the tenant, and then the transaction is akin to the sale of a bond. And that's a matter which is beyond dispute in this case. Both appraisers agree that it's the business success of the tenant that drives the sale price in these cases. The auditor's own appraiser.
The flip side of that is if your client decided to sell this 2 years into the lease, would probably be able to command more than the $2 million you say that is achievable under a typical appraisal, because the next person would also be buying that stream of income with a couple years shorter duration period of time.
And that's correct.
And depending on the capitalization rates at the time.
Depending on the capitalization rates, as it relates to this specific property, like any annuity purchase, as the number of payments remaining go down, you know, the value of that income stream is affected. The value of the underlying real property, however, arguably, depending on the economic time, stays the same, increases, decreases. There's still an underlying value of the real property that's
but
there.
But should the statutes, to follow your argument, should the statutes make an allowance for that? Because a lot of property changes hands that is subject to leases of variety of terms and length, and the lessee may be Does the auditor have to examine every one of these and have somebody there to able to apply the most up-to-date measures of?
Your Honor, from the standpoint of the burden in this case is perfectly instructive. I mean, the auditor in this case did pick up the sale price. And the property owner, receiving notification that the sale price was changed, came forward. The property owner in that case has a burden. So we're not trying to shift that burden to the auditor and say, in doing your mass appraisals, you have to go out and find all this information.
So your argument principally is that as this case gets decided, everybody that makes a decision on this just looks at the transaction price and ignores your evidence. You're not claiming that they have to accept your evidence. Your claim is they have to at least look at it and decide, is your evidence a better, more correct determination of value than the sale price, which is the presumptive determination of value?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. Now, in our case, the Board of Revision did review the evidence. The BTA failed to do so, and that's contrary to this court's Berea decision. In the Berea decision, in paragraph 15, this court said, indeed, as this court has often observed, appraisals based upon factors other than sale price are appropriate only when no arm's length transaction has taken place. Now, the problem is the BTA stops reading there. They say, oh, that's it, we're done, and they don't continue to read. What this court's Berea decision continues to say, or where it is shown that the sale price is not reflective of the true value.
Mr. Ray, did your evidence include a copy of the lease itself? There seems to be some confusion, and I think opposing counsel makes a statement that it is not included in the record, and I don't see it anywhere in our materials.
It was, based upon our records, included. It was the build-to-suit lease arrangement, and so it specifies the type of improvement to be made, the plans to be made, and the
You're
plans
saying
to
the
be
lease
followed.
Was admitted into evidence?
It is my understanding that it was. It's also included as part of the supplement to the merit brief, which was provided to this court with the filing of our brief. I actually think it's the last document, although I apologize, I don't know the page number in the supplement off the top of my head. The question in this case is that both appraisers agree that the sale reflects the business success of the tenant. Ms. Ebert agrees to as much, Mr. Lorms extensively discusses how this particular property reflects the value in use to Walgreens. That value in use, going back to this court's decision and state XREL Park investment, more recently in Higbee's, where a property was looked at and they offered evidence as to the value of the property based upon the gross sales. And this court clearly said, you have to look at the business factors separate from the real property factors. The BTA in this case ultimately doesn't go there, never goes there. Once it looks at the fact that there's an arm's length transaction, it stops. That's contrary to Berea, and it's contrary since then. This court in Strongsville, a 7-0 opinion authored by Justice Lanzinger, looked at a transaction. There were issues of duress there, and there was sale leaseback. You had a Board of Education asking this court, you have to blanketly accept a sale price. This court said no. St. Bernard Storage followed that. Decision authored by Chief Justice Moyer, joined by five of the justices. Justice Pfeiffer joined in the judgment only. In that case, different situation. The property owner and the seller and the buyer agreed to an allocation of the purchase price and a portion of it to real estate. In that case, the court is evaluating it. Mr. Sheevy, Mr. DiMuzio are here in that case saying no. You can't rely upon the recorded sale price that was negotiated between the two parties here because something else is going on. There's a presumption. It's prima facie evidence of value, but it's a rebuttable presumption. Sufficient evidence is provided in this case, which rebuts that presumption. It has been evaluated by the Board of Revision, who found that it rebutted the presumption.
So your position really is we should reverse, send this back to the BTA to complete the analysis.
Your Honor, I think there's two options for this court. What I would tell this court is that the Board of Revision, on the ground in the county evaluating the evidence, evaluated it, applied the analysis, and found that it didn't reflect the true value, and found that the appraisal accepted the value. This court could reinstate the decision of the Board of Revision. Alternatively, the matter could be remanded back to the BTA with instructions that its analysis needs to go beyond that. An analysis, by the way, which only weeks before this Berea decision in the Dayton case, v. Montgomery Board of Revision, the BTA found in substantially similar facts the transaction reflected the use value and reflected the business success of the tenant, and they did not utilize that transaction. They never applied that analysis in this case. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. Mr. Sheevy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and if it may please the court, my name is Tom Sheevy. I'm an assistant county prosecutor, represent the county auditor. With me is David DiMuzio, represents the Amicus Cincinnati School District Board of Education. Next to him is Mr. Franklin Klein. He's an Amicus, represents the Sycamore Community School District Board of Education. And next to him is Mr. John Hust, who represents the Princeton School District. So I think we have all the major school districts in our county involved here. And I'd like to reserve some time for the two amicus briefs, Mr. DiMuzio and Mr. Klein.
You need to watch your time because we get going with questions. And
thank you.
Sometimes amicus don't get much time. So
thank you. To begin with, this is a simple case after Berea. It's an arm's length sale. The appellant never once challenged the fact that this was an arm's length sale, never challenged it at the Board of Revision, never challenged it at the Board of Tax Appeals, never said there was duress involved. His argument here is that it's analogous to a sales leaseback. It's not a sales leaseback. He admitted it wasn't a sales leaseback. He says it's analogous to one.
Well, counsel, I think their argument is this is just the opposite of duress, that in the commercial market, getting a store with a Walgreens lease is the most coveted thing you can own. So people pay a premium for a box because Walgreens is the tenant and the Walgreens lease. That's really, I think, their argument. It's just the flip of duress affecting the sale price.
Well, that's part of it, but their argument is no different than if someone buys the Atrium One building in Cincinnati that houses a Procter & Gamble or a General Electric. People who buy Class A buildings are buying them because they have Class A tenants, and that their rent, their credit worthiness is good and their risk is lower. So simply because you buy a building that has a world-class tenant in it doesn't mean you're buying the business of the world-class tenant. You're buying the building because the building is more secure, it attracts a better tenant, and it attracts better rent. This is typical in any income approach under appraising. You look at the income stream, and you cap that at the end. The income stream for a Class A building is going to be higher than it is for a Class C building. The income stream for a Walgreens is not going to be that much different than its competitors. I pointed out the hearing officer's colloquy with Mr. Lorms. It's on page 16 of my brief, where I think she evidences some confusion about what Mr. Lorms is doing. She asked him over and over, well, isn't this a drugstore market? Aren't there four or five competitors? Well, Mr. Lorms says, yes, there's four or five competitors. The drugstore market is a market unto itself, but he doesn't want to use competitive properties to compare to the subject. He wants to compare abandoned properties that are subject to subleases or to bankruptcies. And as I recall, he doesn't even have, I don't think he has any, maybe he has one, in Hamilton County.
But now we're quarreling about the quality of the appraisal, and the argument is that the BTA didn't even look at it.
And I think under Berea, you don't have to. It's interesting, in Berea, that case dealt with the Kmart. The same law firm argued that case, but argued exactly the opposite of what they're arguing today. In Berea, the Kmart had long-term leases from 20 years ago, and that in their analysis, gave a lower value than here, where they have current leases. So in Berea, the same law firm was arguing that the court should adopt the sale price because a sale is a sale, but here they're saying, well, you should ignore the sale price because here the leases are current and the value is higher. You have a Kmart in Berea, you have a Walgreens here. They're virtually indistinguishable. I don't see how the court can reverse the Board of Tax Appeals without reversing Berea, which you just decided just recently.
I just have to think about that for a minute. With a straight face, you said a Kmart and a Walgreens are indistinguishable.
Well, the cases are. I don't mean the buildings are, obviously.
But the nature of the tenant is, and the nature of the lease would certainly be sort of at the opposite ends of the
real estate
world, wouldn't they?
Well, no, both cases have long-term leases, and both cases are what are generically called big boxes. The Walgreens is not quite as big, and as I mentioned in my citation of additional authorities, you have a case coming up before you.
But Kmart's been floundering and Walgreens is not.
Well, that's true. But you have cases that are coming before you, and they're piled up at the Board of Tax Appeals that deal with Walmarts and Kmarts and Walgreens and Refcos. They're all generic, what are called big boxes. They only differ in size. So if you're going to make an exception, what Mr. Ray is asking the court to do is to carve out, at one point he says, carve out a single tenant exception. In other words, a sale is a sale if it has more than one tenant, but if it only has one tenant, then the court should carve out an exception to that. And there's just no rational basis for
it. Your point is, I think, is that in a arm's length transaction, the sale reflects the value of the building and the business, and it's not to be taken away or valued separately. And that pretty much follows Berea. I think in Berea, I thought we maybe finally, it's hard to create bright line tests in these tax cases. But I thought in Berea we came close to that, probably a little tarnished. But it seems to me we tried to say here's the standard and let's follow the standard. That's what the BTA did here.
I think that's right. In Berea, you instructed the Board of Tax Appeals to ignore the leases. That was the argument in Berea. That was the school board's argument. We're sort of flipped here. It's a funny situation.
Yeah,
in Berea, the school board was arguing Mr. Ray's case. Yeah. Today, they're arguing our case. But the end result was the court said you ignore the leases. The market determines what a property is worth. And the market here was an arm's length sale of $4,375,000. This court has said if you have an arm's length sale, you don't need to look into the appraisal evidence. And it was never disputed anywhere that this was an arm's length sale. They bring in Mr. Lorms, who, incidentally, this isn't a widespread appraisal practice. All these 50 cases involve this law firm and Mr. Lorms, or one of his associates. It's Mr. Lorms' theory that the tenant with one of the best credit ratings in the world pays not less than everybody else. They pay twice as much as everybody else. It doesn't make any sense. I suggested to you that there's a reality check here. If you're the biggest company in the world, like a Walmart, the reason they're the biggest company in the world is because they have this buying power that they can pay less. The appellant's argument is they don't pay less. They pay twice, 2.5 times the rent that everybody else does. It just doesn't make any sense from a common sense point of view. And quite frankly, I think the court just decided Berea. Berea was a Kmart. It was a long-term lease. The court said ignore leases. This case is a long-term lease. It's an arm's-length sale. It's not disputed.
Mr. Sheedy, I take it you disagree with the idea of the rebuttable presumption. In Berea, we do use the term usually. We say it will usually determine the monetary value of the property, which seems to kind of leave the door open. But are you saying that the only way you can present evidence other than the arm's length sale is if you first attack the fact that it was arm's length?
I think that's right. You have to attack the arm's length nature of the sale. And the only exception that the court has carved out for that is if you show duress. In the Springfield case where there was a sale leaseback under duress, the court said that's an exception. It wasn't arm's length because it was duress. So if there's no duress, and simply if you're simply arguing about you don't like the leases, the court in Berea says you ignore the leases. So with that, I'd like to reserve some time for the amicus.
Thank you, Mr. Sheevy. Mr. DiMuzio.
I wanted to talk about two particular items that are present in these cases that I wanted the court to be aware of. If I could make a list of 3 or 4 or 5 most important tenants of real property law in Ohio, one of them is present in this case, and that's the concept of highest and best use. Make no mistake about it. Mr. Ray's argument is attacking the concept of highest and best use. When he talks about value and use and attacks value and use, what he's saying is he doesn't want this court to allow appraisal theory to value properties at their highest and best use if that's also their current use. And our position is that's ridiculous because under our market-driven system, most property owners have every incentive to maximize the use of their property. It's almost always, the value and use is almost always going to be the highest and best use.
Counsel, were any contrary appraisals offered?
I think there was one. I was not involved in the lower case, but yes, I think there was. I'm not arguing appraisals.
By the taxing authorities. I mean, because I think you can make a good argument that they lowballed, their appraiser lowballed this thing.
I understand, but my concern today is more of a philosophical amicus kind of concern that many of the arguments Mr. Ray is raising are not just raised in sale cases. They're raised in this whole theory that big boxes, because of the income stream that was mentioned, because of this large income stream and the credit quality of the tenant, which I'll talk about in a second, because of those two items, he wants you to pretend that the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Sams of the world don't exist, that they're not one of the potential purchasers of the property. Our position and the school's position is the reason the rents are high and the reason that they're paying so much money for these locations is because they're good locations. These are the very, you know, exactly the kinds of things that have always been around. They're all part of appraisal theory, and they're all market-driven. And if you accept Mr. Ray's approach, what you're saying is, well, we're going to pretend that in this case, because of this business success of Walmart,
but
we're going to ignore
that. That's all true, but you can counter that with your own appraisal.
That's
exactly what goes on with Walgreens. They pay an outrageous sum because, I mean, they'll tear down perfectly good buildings just to be at the corner that they want to be on.
That's right. But they have no incentive to pay a nickel more than they have to. And they have such market power that Mr. Ray's position that somehow they overpay makes no sense. On this issue of credit quality of the tenant that was alluded to earlier, it's a very important issue. In every major commercial property that's sold, every building in downtown, purchasers always look to the credit quality of the tenants. If you've got a P&G and an IBM as a tenant, they're interested in that. It's true with notes, but it's also true with any kind of an investment. People worry about income streams. They also worry about the certainty that they're going to be paid next week and next month. And if you adopt his position, what we're saying is it's not unique to single-tenant properties. This concept of credit quality exists everywhere, and it's okay to tax it as real property because the reason the P&Gs are there, the reason the Microsofts are in that particular building, it's the nicest building in town. It commands high rents, it gets the best tenants, and in many cases the longest leases because it's the best location or it's the newest building in town. There are real estate reasons, Your Honors, why the rent's so high. And finally, I was before this court about a year ago on the Dayton Port Authority case, which dealt with construction costs. And there I know the court was very concerned that we not, or that we try to have something on newer buildings fairly close to the construction cost. Mr. Reyes admitted in his brief that oftentimes these Walmart leases are a reflection of construction costs. They're not some wild overpaying. It's simply another way of financing it, and the cost and the value are often very similar to the construction cost. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DiMuzio. Mr. Klain.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices Frank Klain for the Sycamore Community School District. I'd just like to reiterate a few points that have been previously made, and answering one of the questions was presented by the justices as to what impact this has on the auditor's offices. Well, it creates a hypothetical and speculative system. They have a bright line test in Berea, which is the arm's length sale, and they use the Walters case, which determines what is an arm's length sale. Now, if we go beyond that at this present time, we create a system that is going to be extremely difficult for each auditor in each county, or even every BTA as the cases proceed. And that's a major concern. We do have a test now that works. Yes, the court has carved out some exceptions, but not in this particular case. There's no evidence presented in this case that this was other than an arm's length sale. That's clear from the record. I think one of the other points is that looking at this type of transaction, obviously sophisticated people involved who are working and looking for their economic best interest, both from a seller standpoint and from a buyer standpoint. It's the same that happens in most every commercial transaction. They're negotiating a price, they come up with something that's satisfactory to them, and that's the sale price. And they certainly, as Mr. DiMuzio indicates, they consider the income stream. That's how they determine what they're going to buy. But they come to a price and they buy it. I think that the impact of this case and creating a change in the direction as to how properties are valued or sold like this would be disastrous for the school districts. School districts, in our particular Sycamore Community School District, we have many, many, many large stores similar to this. It will result in a tremendous decrease in value, ultimately, which will be to the detriment of the taxpayers. You know, we would urge affirmance of the decision by the Board of Tax Appeals. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Klain. Mr. Ray, you saved 2.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Several issues here to address. This property is not a downtown office building with tenants in it. The evidence establishes the unique nature of this property. It's a build-to-suit property. This property is unique to Walgreens. It has a specific floor plan, a specific size. It's a specific door in the same place. The pharmacy, the drive-throughs, everything are unique. What the evidence shows is that when these properties are available and this initial build-to-suit lease is not on there, these properties are not selling for what they would be if Walgreens was in there. It's clear, both from Mr. Lorms and Ms. Ebert, that it's the creditworthiness of the tenant. We're going to allow properties which are substantially similar, contrary to this court's Higbee decision, for the value to change depending upon a tenant. So if I have an exact building in the Higbee's, exactly the same as Higbee's, one has a Nordstrom in it, one has Higbee's in it, the other one has a Burlington Coat Factory.
Well, there wasn't, in Higbee's, am I wrong, there wasn't a sale in Higbee's.
There was not a sale.
Yeah, isn't that a major difference?
No, I think
that an arm's length transaction.
Again, what they would ask this court to do is simply find once there's an arm's length sale, the analysis is done. We say that's not this court's decision. It's not this court's decision and never has been. Once we start looking at the question of whether this reflects value, that makes a difference. And so in this case, it's the same concern that Justice Pfeiffer mentioned in his concurring opinion in Berea. If we adopt a standard that says it's arm's length and we stop, you open up the floodgates at that point. school board's worried about loss of revenue. You open up the floodgates to every possible concoction of transaction in order to decrease the value of the property.
It seems to me, counsel, that it's just the opposite, that if we consider Berea to be a bright line test, and everybody knows what it is, that there are not going to be these challenges and offers of other evidence, because if we say the property, the sale price of the property reflects the value of the property as it's used, that's all part of the sale price of the property, then we wouldn't have challenges, would we, or at least unless there's duress. I mean, now if we're assuming there's, I think Berea has to assume, we have to assume that there's a sale price or a transaction without duress, without the exceptions that we would apply. But if there's a sale that is an arm's length transaction, why doesn't that just make a clear, sort of a clear extent that we can make anything clear in this area? Why isn't that a clear test that can be applied?
Because you are now valuing property based upon the use to which it's put. That is only allowed in Ohio, to the best of my knowledge, as it relates to agricultural use value, and it required a change. Article 12, Section 2 of the Ohio Constitution requires uniform taxation. If we're going to uniformly tax these properties, we have to look at the value of the underlying real estate, and as this court said in Higbee's, pull out the business value from the real estate value. And the last issue, and Your Honor, is that we talk about, and they bring up this issue as it relates to the monetary issue, and I don't want to drag this court back into school funding by any means, but when we get into how the House Bill 920 calculations work, where that amount of money that original bond passage was supposed to raise, those reduction factors work so that amount is raised. If we said every property in that particular jurisdiction was worth a dollar, it would raise the same amount. Now, it raises phantom revenue issues, and I'm not sure this court wants or desires to go back there.
Not in this case.
As it relates to whether it's going to raise the same money, it's not a financial issue at all. And Your Honor, I know I'm out of time. May I just briefly summarize?
Just briefly sum up.
All right, sure. Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, the evidence shows that this court's Berea decision requires an analysis. It's prima facie evidence, and it can be rebutted. The Board of Revision in this case found that it was rebutted, and the BTA didn't even engage in a transaction. We'd ask this court to reinstate the decision of the Board of Revision, find that the value of the underlying real estate as of the tax lien date is $1,950,000. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.